Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Michael, reading the Midland Reporter-Telegram for Saturday, October 10th, 2020. Front page. Nuclear waste storage in Andrews. Midlanders back Abbott's nuke opposition. By Caitlin Randall. After Governor Greg Abbott, in a letter to President Donald Trump last week, stated his opposition to a proposed nuclear waste site in Andrews County, Midlanders, who have been fighting the proposal for years, said they appreciated the governor's support. Abbott's letter came 4 months after a U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission panel recommended approval of the site. Interim Storage Partners had applied for a license in 2016 to temporarily store high-level waste at the site before it would be moved to a permanent repository. A permanent storage site has yet to be built, though, after federal funding for the Yucca Mountain Project fell through in 2011. Critics said temporary storage facilities should not be approved until a permanent repository is established. In his letter to Trump, Abbott said the state of Texas did not consent to being used for the storage of high-level nuclear waste. Because of the many risks associated with these projects, the lack of a permanent storage facility, and the importance of the Permian Basin to the economy and energy security of the country, I respectfully urge you to join me in opposing the siting of an interim storage facility in Texas or in New Mexico, Abbott wrote. Several Midlanders who have been adamantly opposed to the Andrews site, including Midland County Commissioner Randy Prude, said they hoped the governor's support would influence the president. "I'm so grateful he's joining the fight publicly," Prude said of Abbott. Prude has been a strong opponent of the project since it was first proposed, and in 2017 led a resolution from the commissioner's court that stated the county's opposition to high-level nuclear waste being transported on trains through Midland County. "The reason I've been outspoken is, if you put nuclear waste in casks, there's only a matter of time before there's an accident," he said. The proposed project would store high-level waste in the form of dry pellets, about the size of a pencil eraser, in above-ground casks. Prude has attended several hearings by the NRC on the proposal and said he's also recruited others opposed to the site, including Fasken Oil and Ranch. Tommy Taylor, director of oil and gas development at Fasken, told the Reporter-Telegram he was pleased that Abbott had weighed in on the topic. "I think he is right to be very concerned about siting this material here," he said. "We are way too important for the economic and energy security to Texas and the United States to take any risk with this material, no matter how low the risks are claimed to be by their proponents." Fasken has submitted a contention to the NRC regarding the site, and Taylor spoke on behalf of Fasken at an NRC hearing in July 2019. He previously said he believes a nuclear waste site in West Texas could shut down the oil industry. Another critic of the site who has worked with Prude and Taylor to raise awareness of the project is David Rosen, a Midland geologist and former Democratic Party chair. Rosen said objection to Interim Storage's proposal has had bipartisan support because Republicans and Democrats agree that oil and gas is essential for national defense. He said both parties share concerns about an accident affecting the oil industry and are working together to fight the project. "It shows that when we can get past rhetoric and talk about specific issues, there's a lot we can agree on," he said. Prude said he hopes the camaraderie between Republicans and Democrats will continue and spill over into other areas. "Maybe they can even agree on the Dune sagebrush lizard and greater prairie chicken," he said. Education. MISD sets special meeting to consider new name for Lee, by Stuart Doreen. The Midland ISD Board will consider recommendations and possibly take action regarding the renaming of Robert E. Lee High School during a special meeting next week. The district posted on Friday afternoon that a special meeting is planned for 5:30 p.m. Wednesday inside the auditorium at Bowie Fine Arts Academy, 805 Elk Avenue. Board officials had said they hope to decide on the renaming at their regularly scheduled meeting in October, scheduled for October 19th. However, the district announced there will be a pair of special meetings next week. Officials expect numerous people to speak during the public forum portion of Wednesday's meeting. The Citizens Renaming Committee voted for Legacy of Equality and Excellence as its number one choice for the high school and the freshman school. Tall City Hall School is the second choice. Rebels was voted as the first choice for a mascot for Legacy of Equality and Excellence. Oilers is the number one choice for the mascot for Tall City Hall School. Midland ISD provided information to the Reporter-Telegram earlier this week that a name change could cost as much as $3.469 million. The meeting on Wednesday could end weeks of community discussion about the Lee High School name issue. In July, the board, by a 6-1 vote, decided to rename the Robert E. Lee High School and the Freshman School. Midland ISD said that people who wish to speak during the public comment portion of the meeting should sign up from 4:30 to 5:20 p.m. The district also announced that it will follow health and safety guidelines at the meeting. Seating arrangements will be spaced to promote safe distancing, and masks will be required of all on-site attendees, MISD wrote on the agenda notice. The district will also have masks and hand sanitizer available to all members of the public who wish to attend. Seating will be limited in the main auditorium based on the safe distancing guidelines the district must follow. Seating will be available on a first-come, first-served basis. The district will prepare an additional viewing room at the location for members of the public who did not get a seat in the main auditorium. Please note that you may also view this meeting via live stream. Energy. Crude oil prices stay above $40, by Mella McEwen. Crude prices moved higher this week, giving back some gains on Friday. West Texas Intermediate on the New York Mercantile Exchange dropped 59 cents, or about 1% Friday, to close at $40.60 per barrel. This compares to Monday, when prices jumped $2.17 to close at $39.22 per barrel. That was followed by a $1.45 gain Tuesday that put prices back above $40 a barrel. Prices fell to $39.95 Wednesday before closing at $41.19 Thursday. The posted price ended the week at $37 per barrel. Natural gas prices on the NYMEX started the week off with an 18-cent jump and largely added to those gains, with the exception of a 9.5-cent drop Tuesday. Prices rose 11.4 cents Friday to close at $2.741 per MCF. Bloomberg reports prices were poised for a 10% gain for the week, the biggest since June, boosted largely by the approach of Hurricane Delta, which is forcing the shutdown of almost 92% of Gulf of Mexico oil output. The support from Delta was mitigated by Norway being set for talks with its oil workers to avoid a strike that could take 1 million barrels off the market, Bloomberg said. Bloomberg said optimism over a government stimulus package may be limited by a resurgence in COVID-19 cases that could weaken demand at the same time OPEC Plus and Libya are adding more oil supplies. Fasken Oil and Ranch is not anticipating a significant rise in the current oil price until the COVID-19 pandemic is over and oil demand returns to more traditional levels, Tommy Taylor, director of oil and gas development, told the Reporter-Telegram by email. The company has recently taken out drilling permits in Andrews and Ector counties. Jennifer Martin Samuels, vice president, investor relations with SM Energy, told the Reporter-Telegram by email that while oil prices have been volatile, the current forward strip is in line with our operating plan, and we are on track to add a completions crew in the Midland Basin later this month. The company recently took out drilling permits in Upton and Howard counties. Unless someone is day trading commodities, week-to-week variations do not mean a whole lot, and producers are going to look for what the prices are projected to do long-term before engaging on any substantial drilling completion activity, Michael Banschenbach, oil, gas, and NGL marketing consultant, told the Reporter-Telegram by email. I agree that unless something significant in the supply and or demand picture changes, then crude prices will vary up and down in probably a fairly narrow range of $35 to $45. U.S. rig count rises for fourth straight week. Permian tally rises to 130, by Mella McEwen. The U.S. rig count continues to claw its way back from record lows brought about by the COVID-19 pandemic and oil market crash. Baker Hughes, which has tracked the rig count weekly since the 1940s, reported Friday that the rig count posted its fourth consecutive rise, rising three rigs to 269 at work nationally, There were 193 rigs drilling for oil, up 4 for the week, and 73 drilling for natural gas, down 1 for the week. The rig count is 587 rigs below the 856 at work this time a year earlier. Texas added 3 rigs for 116 at work statewide, down 304 from the 420 Baker Hughes reported last year. New Mexico joined Texas as the only producing state to gain rigs, rising 1 to 45. Pennsylvania was the only producing state to decline, dropping 1 rig. The Permian Basin added 1 rig to 130, but is 291 rigs below the 421 a year ago. Eddy County, New Mexico remains the most active in the Permian with 25 rigs, up 1. Lee County, New Mexico followed with 20 rigs, unchanged for the week. Martin County reported 18 rigs at work within county lines, the same as the previous week. Midland County had 16 rigs, down 1 for the week. Cochran County saw renewed activity with 1 rig at work, while Borden, Hockley, and Yoakum counties didn't have any activity this week. MISD Board could okay separation with Riddick, by Stuart Doreen. The Midland ISD Board will consider and take possible action on a voluntary separation agreement with outgoing Superintendent Orlando Riddick at a special meeting Monday. The district on Friday posted an announcement of the meeting, which is scheduled for 5:30 p.m. Monday in room 620 at the administration building. The agenda states the board will come back from a closed session and take up the following action items. Public hearing pursuant to Texas Local Government Code Section 180.007 regarding payment to be made to Orlando Riddick. Consider and take possible action to approve voluntary separation agreement with Orlando Riddick. Consider and take possible action regarding superintendent search and transition process. I expect we will be approving a mutually agreeable resolution of our employment relationship with Mr. Riddick, Board President Rick Davis told the Reporter Telegram on Friday. Earlier this week, trustees authorized Davis and legal counsel to negotiate and finalize possible settlement terms with Riddick. The board had started termination proceedings with Riddick in August. The most recent action in the process occurred on October 1st when Riddick requested an independent hearing following the board's vote to propose termination. Riddick's salary is $275,000. His contract is set to expire on June 30th, 2022. Davis wrote in an op-ed that appeared in the August 31st edition of the Reporter Telegram that the decision to terminate the contract had to do with the district's academic performance. In short, because the district was making either no progress, little progress, or even worse, regressing on a majority of the goal progress measures regarding student academic performance on which Mr. Riddick understood and agreed he would be evaluated, we made the unanimous decision to take the first step in seeking a new academic leader for our district, Davis wrote. Chevron to lay off 700 in Houston, by Paul Takahashi, Houston Chronicle. Chevron plans to lay off 700 workers in Houston this month in response to the coronavirus-driven oil downturn. The layoffs will affect workers at Chevron's downtown Houston offices starting October 23rd, according to a notice sent to the Texas Workforce Commission in August. The layoffs, first reported by wire service Reuters on Thursday, are part of Chevron's efforts to streamline its business, to build upon its strengths and maintain competitiveness in the ever-changing external environment, the company said. More Chevron layoffs are expected in Houston after its multi-billion dollar acquisition of Houston-based Noble Energy this month. The California oil giant earlier said it is looking to cut redundant office positions as well as reduce costs for consultants, office buildings, technology, and insurance. Chevron earlier this year announced plans to lay off 6,000 workers globally by the end of the year. Other energy majors are reorganizing their businesses and laying off thousands of employees in the face of low oil prices and a weakening outlook for fossil fuel demand amid growing concerns about climate change. Shell last month announced plans to cut up to 9,000 jobs over the next 2 years. BP plans to lay off 10,000 workers globally by the end of the year, and Exxon is undertaking a country-by-country review that may result in layoffs. Chevron said it has increased its resources available to laid-off workers, including enhanced severance and extending the employer contribution toward continuing medical insurance coverage. In addition, employees will have access to education and training resources and extended career transition services, the company said. Obituaries for Saturday, August 10th. Donald Lee Tidwell, 1934 to 2020. An avid gardener, always having the best yard on the block, Don Tidwell passed away at his home surrounded by loved ones on Saturday, October 3rd, after a long battle with Parkinson's. Born September 18, 1934, to Edward and Grace Tidwell in Wink, Texas. Don is preceded in death by his mother, father, brothers Billy and Bobby, sisters Nita, Doris, and Linda, and son Terry. He is survived by his loving wife of 40 years, Jan, sons Larry Tidwell and wife Mary of Louisville, Texas, Mike Tidwell and wife Patty of Peebles, Ohio, Matt Tidwell of Bedford, Texas, daughter Sherry Roberts and husband Bill of Midland, brothers Kenneth Tidwell of Andrews, and Teddy Tidwell of Odessa, 9 grandchildren and 9 great-grandchildren. A private graveside service will be held in Kermit, Texas at Thanksgiving. Freddie Carnes. Freddie Carnes left this world freed from pain and suffering to enter into her eternal home in the glorious presence of her Lord and Savior Jesus Christ on October 6, 2020. She was born in McAllen, Texas on June 24, 1934. On April 24, 1954, she married Les Carnes, whom she had known since the third grade. They were married for 66 years. She is survived by her husband, Les Carnes, their daughters, Danielle Pureyear of Midland, and Julie Morgan and husband Greg of Prosper, grandchildren Jennifer Latshaw of Omaha, Leslie Hoover and husband John of Allen, Tracy Simmons and husband Jared of Prosper, and Tyler Wilkinson and wife Barry of Selena, and 8 beautiful great-grandchildren. Friends and family members are invited to attend the funeral service officiated by James Irvin on Monday, October 12th at 2 p.m. at the Chapel of First Baptist Church in Midland. Funeral service is under the direction of Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home and Chapel. Family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin@nts-online.net, or you can visit our website at www.llewellyngarciapipkinfh.com.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Saturday, October 10th, 2020. Section A. New incentives coming for ECISD teachers. National Board Certification for Teachers, the State Teacher Allotment Incentive, Opportunity, Culture, and other initiatives are being offered through Ector County ISD to attract and retain instructors. Ector County ISD Superintendent Scott Murray led an ECISD live broadcast Thursday night about attracting, retaining, and developing teachers. Executive Director of Talent Development Ashley Osborne, Christine Mason, Talent Development Coach, and Pedro Laguna, a multi-classroom leader at Sam Houston Elementary School, participated. Osborne said ECISD will help teachers navigate National Board Certification. Murray said he got his National Board Certification and it changed who he was as a teacher and who he is today as a leader. In ECISD, you're not only going to have that opportunity, but we're actually going to support teachers in that process. We're going to pay for it, Murray said. The cost is $2,000 per teacher. From a parent perspective, this will help teachers who go through this process become even better. So another piece to attract teachers to our area, Murray said. On opportunity culture, Osborne said at its most basic level, it is a chance to get highly effective teachers in front of more students. There are currently 8 campuses participating in Opportunity Culture, and 8 more are set for next school year. The 8 campuses this year are Blackshear Elementary, E.K. Downing Elementary, Ross Elementary, Sam Houston Elementary, Crockett Middle School, Nimitz Middle School, Wilson and Young Middle School, and Odessa High School. ECISD recently announced that 8 more schools will begin the planning and design of Opportunity Culture at Bowie Middle School, Dowling Elementary, Fly Elementary, Goliad Elementary, LBJ Elementary, Knoll Elementary, Pease Elementary, and Permian High School. Teacher incentive allotment, Murray said, is part of House Bill 3. It provides a chance for school districts statewide to recognize their best teachers, those who are most effective, and compensate them at a very different level. Districts do not have to engage in this process, but ECISD decided our teachers deserve this. We are an early adopter. We're undergoing the process right now, Murray said. The district recently submitted its application to the state and received the highest rating. The real work is happening right now as we are working through the application to complete the process, Murray said. If all goes well, it will roll out next year. A signature. What it will do specifically is provide a significant compensation up to an additional $26,000 a year for the most effective teachers in ECISD who choose to teach our most fragile schools, Murray said. The nice thing about the dollars is it really not only recognizes the very best, but it also recognizes those who have chosen to serve our most fragile students in the school district. And again, the teacher incentive allotment is a great way to attract great teachers. We're thrilled to be able to do this. Osborne added that teachers who earn national certification also qualify for more money. Murray said those who earn the designation can earn between $3,000 and $9,000 in additional compensation every year. The reason for the difference is because of the difference in the school you serve, Murray said. Those serving in high-poverty schools can earn up to $9,000 a year more, and those in schools with less need can receive an additional $3,000, he said. Mason said her role as talent development coach is to provide a strong support system at the campus level for new teachers who are trained throughout the summer and into the fall. And we provide mentorship teachers on their individual campuses. We've got multiple levels of support for our instructional staff, our teachers, so we can meet them where they are, individualize their personal needs, and support them in what their needs dictate or tell us that will help them get better, Mason said. Laguna, a multi-classroom leader, is from Spain and has taught in many other countries. This will be his 5th year with ECISD, and believe it or not, I love it. I like the sense of community I have right here, Laguna said. He noted that there are several requirements teachers from other countries have to meet, but he encouraged prospective instructors to find out more by visiting the ECISD website or sending him an email. Osborne said the district recruits teachers from Spain, Jamaica, the Philippines, India, and Mexico. It also participates in job fairs, although those have been virtual of late due to COVID-19. They also post on several job boards from Indeed to college job boards. I'm proud to say we have a 98% fill rate right now for our teachers. This is a tremendous increase from last year. That's exciting news. We have really quality people in our classrooms with our students, Osborne said. Last year, ECISD had 350 teaching vacancies. Murray said now there are less than 40. Along with the international initiatives, Osborne said there are local Grow Your Own programs with University of Texas Permian Basin and Odessa College, and ECISD has its own alternative certification program with Odessa Pathway to Teaching. Application deadline for the latest Odessa Pathway to Teaching cohort is October 30th. growing our own is important, Murray said. 60% of teachers in the U.S. teach within 25 miles of the high schools they graduated from. OC professors present at Education and Literacy Conference. Professors from Odessa College recently made their work known through virtual presentations at the Adult Education and Literacy Fall Institute. This was the first time that anyone could remember that OC had presented at the conference, held September 14th to 17th. The Adult Education and Literacy Fall Institute 2020 is under the state's AEL program that transitioned from the Texas Education Agency, TEA, to the TWC Workforce Development Division in 2013. Charity Embley and Christy Latimer, both associate professors of education, and associate professor of English Mary Hansen participated. The Adult Education and Literacy Institute made virtual presentations. Embley and Latimer presented together. Their presentation was called, Are You for Real? REAL stands for Retraining, Employment, and Literacy. Embley said it is action research based on their English as a Second Language classes that are geared toward professionals. Most of her students, she said, come from Colombia, Argentina, Vietnam, India, Mexico, and Spain, Embley said, and many of them have bachelor's or master's degrees. Her students want to work in the U.S., so they were able to come up with a framework to help them acquire language, use workforce development concepts, and help them find a job. Embley said they want to integrate the literacy and language acquisition with something practical that they can use in the workforce. Many of Embley's students are already professionals in their home countries. She said the Texas Workforce Commission is interested in the REAL model and replicating it in other organizations. Through the model, we're encouraging ESL students to go out and work, but we're basing it on their skills and whatever the industry has to offer. The Midland and Odessa area is the oil field, so they're coming here to the U.S. because their husbands or spouses work in the oil field as engineers. They are also skilled workers in their own countries, Embley said. They have 20 in the program so far, and the course started in the spring. I did a boot camp this summer, and I really tested the workforce development concept, bringing along financial literacy, career readiness, college, and career readiness. I did a lot of workforce concepts like resume development, mock interviews, dress for success, and job preparation. Adult Education and Literacy Director Denise Perdue said, they cap each class at 25 students because of the language skill development that's needed and the one-on-one attention that's needed. Perdue added that the retention rate for the class has been really high. We do offer the course year-round, Perdue said. She added that the beauty of it is that students can work from wherever they need to. Embley and Perdue said the test scores students get show they are ready for college coursework. Latimer presented the engagement portion classes. She said she works hard to find fun and engaging things for students to do. Latimer said they have the same structure every day, but they offer things like movie clip Monday and talk about it Tuesday. They are actually teaching on Tuesdays. They don't have an option. I call on them. They know to be prepared, and they present PowerPoints, Latimer said. She has a dentist who has presented on cavities, and others have presented on exercising, weightlifting, all kinds of things that they're interested in. Embley said Wednesdays are choose your topic for her, which is similar to Latimer's approach. Hansen presented dyslexia is not a bad word. She is a dyslexia therapist and what is called a QI, or qualified instructor. Hansen said she hated the reason why the conference was virtual, but it enabled her to still do her work at OC. It was an odd environment with no audience reaction. I felt I got to meet some very interesting and knowledgeable people around the state that otherwise I would not have been able to do while still meeting my daily duties. It was a very good use of time, and I had the support of OC in doing that. I feel like it was a win-win, and that's hard to pull off, Hansen said. Quick hits. MOSC concert canceled. Midland Odessa Symphony and Chorale's Board of Directors held an emergency meeting last week to discuss the fate of the symphony's November concert. Due to ongoing concerns related to the COVID-19 pandemic, the Board of Directors voted to cancel Concierto de Amor, scheduled for November 7th at the Wagner Knoll Performing Arts Center. Despite the cancellation, MOSC confirms that the musicians will be compensated. This difficult decision comes after extensive talks with the executive director, MOSC music director Gary Lewis, staff, and the board executive committee. The guest artist scheduled for November was vocalist Barbara Padilla, former contestant on America's Got Talent. The program required a large orchestra, which logistically was difficult given the size of the stage and social distancing requirements. As of now, MOSC's annual holiday performance in December and the rest of the scheduled season are a go. However, the organization is committed to doing what is best for the safety of all and will monitor each event on a case-by-case basis. Board President Patrick Canty said, "I am confident the MOSC will weather this pandemic storm. We just need to continue to stay positive and to do the right thing when it comes to protecting our musicians and our patrons. We love them both too dearly to do otherwise." Current ticket holders will receive an email from Wagner Knoll Performing Arts Center with refund information. Midland Odessa Symphony and Chorale is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, and due to the major financial impact of concert cancellations, patrons are asked to consider donating their refund back to MOSC to help support them through this difficult time. Visit www.mosc.org. Local News Roundup. Fine Arts Connection Program. The Ellen Knoll Art Museum is offering the Fine Arts Connection Program online for third grade students to virtually tour exhibitions at knollartmuseum.org. The museum has a limited amount of free art kits available at the front desk that students can take home until November 8th. For more information, call Ashley Flores at 432-550-9696, extension 214, or marketing@knollartmuseum.org. Traffic update. University Boulevard will be closed from Dawn Avenue to Redbud Avenue beginning the evening of October 16th through October 30th. AT&T will be installing new underground fiber cable for communications purposes. Motorists are advised to take alternative routes. Local News Roundup. Man charged with shooting firearm around children. A 47-year-old man was arrested after he reportedly fired a gun in the presence of children and was involved in a standoff with the Odessa Police Department, OPD. Robert Zamora was charged with endangering a child, a state jail felony. The reported incident happened at 11:16 p.m. Thursday in the 1600 block of Petroleum Drive, an OPD press release stated. Dispatch reportedly detailed that a man, later identified as Zamora, was shooting a gun inside the residence, and there were children inside the residence. Zamora exited the residence with his children and fired a round into the ground before going back inside. Officers attempted to make contact with Zamora, but he refused to comply with commands and barricaded himself inside the residence, the press release stated. The SWAT team and crisis negotiation team responded to the scene, and a search warrant was obtained. Zamora was reportedly taken into custody without incident at 4 a.m. Friday. There were no reports of any injuries. He was booked into the Ector County Law Enforcement Center Friday, jail records show. He has one bond totaling $7,500 and was still in custody as of Monday afternoon. Cold case accused killer booked into Ector County Jail. The 58-year-old man who was arrested after his DNA from a cigarette butt matched a semen sample that was collected from a fatal stabbing that happened in 1982 was booked into the Ector County Law Enforcement Center Thursday night. Billy Wayne Ludwigson, 58, was charged September 30th with murder, a first-degree felony. Ludwigson was extradited from Denver to Odessa and was booked into the Ector County Jail at 8:17 p.m. Thursday, jail records show. He has one bond totaling $500,000 and was still in custody as of Friday afternoon. Jail records detailed that Ludwigson was indicted by an Ector County grand jury for the murder charge. The reported fatal stabbing happened between 5 and 8 a.m. April 19, 1982, near a culvert on the west side of the Permian Mall, which is now known as Music City Mall, near Tanglewood Lane, an OPD affidavit detailed. Velma Nettie Nessert, 64, was employed by Permian Mall, and she commonly walked from her apartment, which was located two blocks west of the mall, to start her shift at 5 a.m. On April 19, 1982, Nessert failed to arrive for work and didn't call in sick. Throughout the morning, mall employees reportedly called her residence and searched the area between her apartment and the mall. Nessert's daughter searched her apartment and reported her missing to OPD. At 12:58 p.m., April 19, 1982, an OPD officer found Nessert in a drainage culvert on the west side of the mall near Tanglewood Lane. She was lying supine and was stabbed in her throat, the affidavit stated. Her shirt was lifted and exposed her lower torso. Her pants and underwear had been pulled down, which exposed her genitalia. An autopsy reportedly showed that Nessert's cause of death to be exsanguinations secondary to the stab wound in her neck. Her death was estimated between 5 and 8 a.m., April 19, 1982. During the initial investigation, Nessert's co-worker reported that on April 19, 1982, at 4:30 a.m., while traveling to work, they saw a white male between 18 and 19 years old walking north on Tanglewood Lane in the immediate vicinity of the culvert where Nessert was found. The witness stated the man to be medium build with dark, wavy, neck-length hair. In 2007, a forensic examination was performed on the clothing Nessert wore, the affidavit stated. A semen stain was found on the exterior portion of a jacket Nessert wore at the time of her death. A DNA profile was obtained from the stain and submitted to combined DNA index systems. Ludwigson, who resided in Colorado in July 2020, was reportedly identified as a potential suspect. A criminal history check showed that he had been arrested March 13, 1982 and March 28, 1982 by OPD, which was within weeks of Nessert's death. A review of the 1982 booking photos showed that Ludwigson matched the physical description of the individual described by the witness in the area of the fatal stabbing, the affidavit stated. On July 10, 2020, physical surveillance was reportedly conducted on Ludwigson's last known address. He walked to a nearby restaurant and purchased to-go meals before walking back to his residence. He was positively identified using known information on scars and tattoos as well as photo comparisons. A day later, Ludwigson was sitting at a public bus stop, and while at the bus stop, he hand-rolled a cigarette, the affidavit stated. He smoked the cigarette and discarded the cigarette butt on a public street in front of the bench where he sat. The cigarette butt was recovered and submitted to the crime laboratory for analysis. A DNA profile reportedly obtained from the cigarette butt was submitted to the DPS Safety Crime Laboratory to be compared to the semen sample. Laboratory analysis showed that Ludwigson was confirmed to be the contributor of the semen sample. Odessa's Bank of America location closed. A sign in the window of Odessa's Bank of America, located in the 700 block of North Grant Avenue, details the branch is temporarily closed. However, the reason for the closure has not been disclosed, but the Odessa American has learned the Bank of America branch will be closed for 14 days. The Odessa American sent an email Friday morning requesting the reason for the closure to Bank of America Regional Media Relations Manager Brittany Sheehan. ICA spokesperson Matt Rist stated via text message that he can't confirm anything on behalf of Bank of America, but shared the contact information with the Odessa American for Sheehan. Death notices for Saturday, October 10th. Epimenio Papo Salinas, Jr. Epimenio Papo Salinas, Jr., 74, of Odessa, died Tuesday, October 6th at Medical Center Hospital. Mass will be celebrated at 10 a.m. Wednesday, October 14th at St. Joseph's Catholic Church. Burial with military honors will follow at Ector County Cemetery, Odessa 2 section, with Father Frank Chavez officiating. Arrangements are by Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory of Odessa. Jorge A. Dominguez. Jorge A. Dominguez, 45, died Thursday, October 8th in Odessa. Services are pending with Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory of Odessa. Rafael Lujan Nieto. Rafael Lujan Nieto, 70, died Thursday, October 8th in Odessa. Services are pending with Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory of Odessa.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter-Telegram for Sunday, October 11th, 2020. Lee naming situation. A commentary by Rick Davis, MISD Board President. Midland should celebrate school's legacy with new name. On July 27th, 2020, the vote to change the name of Robert E. Lee High School and Robert E. Lee Freshman School occurred. I believed it was the right thing to do for all the reasons described in my article published on July 26th, making the case for a change. I still do. The question now is, what should the new name be? The committee recommends Legacy of Equality and Excellence. The runner-up choice is Tall City. The difference between these two options is stark. Too stark. Initially, I was open to the possibility of LEE acronym option, but am now not persuaded Lee High School does not go far enough in disassociating ourselves from having a public school named to honor a Confederate general who fought for the Southern state's ability to continue the abominable institution of slavery. And it's too gimmicky. Its proponents dismiss such objections, but there is no doubt they support that option so they can continue to call it Lee High School, not Legacy of Equality and Excellence High School. There are also those among the acronym supporters who maintain changing the name without at least keeping Lee will somehow erase their high school experiences and take away their accomplishments. It will not. Nothing can do that. Alumni will continue to fondly remember their experiences and proudly boast, as well they should, of their achievements, which should continue to be displayed in the school's hallways and on campus for all to see and remember. However, I am also persuaded Tall City High School goes too far and does not seek to honor the school's legacy of accomplishments. And for many, it requires a cumbersome explanation. Nevertheless, there is wisdom in the views expressed regarding these two naming options. For example, in choosing the new name, we should be mindful we are not starting with a blank slate. This school has a long and proud history of student achievement. We should seek to honor that history. Tall City High School does not do that. At the same time, we must also acknowledge the angst associated with the misguided origin of the existing name, its Confederate symbols, and that portion of the alma mater with the concluding exalting words of Robert E. Lee sung at the end of every football game and graduation. We should seek to turn away from such associations. LEE High School does not do that. For all these reasons, I propose the new LHS be Legacy High School, and its mascot be the Rebels, as represented during the American Revolutionary War period, as recommended by the committee. After all, Rebels captures the spirit of this school far more than any acronym, and its redepicting, memorializing our country's against all odds success in becoming an independent nation could redeem that mascot name and continue the pride of being a rebel. As for how it is redepicted, I suggest the committee reconvene, solicit possible redepictions of such mascot from the community, and submit their top two selections to the students at Lee High School for a vote. I also propose the school's colors remain maroon and white, as also recommended by the committee, because those colors have no inherent association with the Confederacy. Some may object to the mascot name, even if redepicted, and the school colors, but if there is to be anything that could be accepted as a compromise on this school naming issue, I am convinced it cannot be an acronym spelling out the very same name, but it can come in the form of a newly depicted rebel mascot and keeping the school colors. Again, we are not starting with a blank slate here. Instead, what this seeks to do is change what should be changed and keep what can be kept. Yes, there is a cost associated with making this right, and yes, it remains to be seen just how much, if any, such cost may be offset by any money that may be raised by those who have volunteered to do so. In any event, while some of the changes should be implemented as soon as possible, I would not anticipate all changes resulting from a name change would be implemented immediately. For example, the timing of a bond designed to address our secondary facility needs would be one reason not to implement all changes immediately. If, for instance, a bond next November proposes to relocate LHS to a new campus and repurpose the existing campus, all the campus ramifications of this name change can be included on the new LHS campus at no additional cost. And even if such a bond does not occur or pass, some of the changes may need to be implemented over time for a variety of other reasons, including cost, and so patience will be required. In any event, it is time to put this name change decision behind us once and for all. It's the right thing to do for our community, especially for the long term. I hope my fellow board members agree. For those alleging the board has spent too much time on this name-changing issue and should, instead, be focused on responding to the challenges of dealing with COVID and improving academic performance, please know we have met 11 times over the last 2.5 months, including the meeting at which we made the name-changing decision, including the time spent by others during public comment over which we have no control. We have met for almost 32 hours. Only 4% of that time was spent on this name change issue. The remaining 96% of the time was spent on other matters, including 1, ending our employment relationship with our superintendent, 2, hiring an interim superintendent focused on supporting our principals and teachers, 3, returning students to the classroom, and 4, seeking to improve their academic performance. Those efforts will continue, and everyone's support of them for the benefit of our students and teachers would be most appreciated. I trust those are matters which we can all agree. A commentary by Blake Felt and Shannon Lowe from the Citizens Renaming Committee co-chairman. Strength of MISD Board's committee evident in balanced voting. It is fair to say that the last 12 months have been like no other. The bust of 2020 will be remembered by a failed school bond, the COVID-19 pandemic, plummeting oil prices, a struggling economy, and the renaming of the beloved Midland Lee High School. As an air of division and disappointment fills our nation, it is evident that our wonderful community is not immune to the political and social unrest that surrounds us. During these very difficult times, we knew the task of renaming Robert E. Lee High School was going to draw very strong opinions from both sides of the issue. However, we had visions of using the name change as an opportunity to unite our town. Could we come together to find a way to preserve the great traditions and accomplishments of our school, while also eliminating the association of our school name with the Confederate ties to Civil War times? It did not take long to see the enormity of the task at hand. Midland is known around the state and nation for our grit, wildcatter mentality, and the culture of success driven by the oil and gas business. We are a town that has produced presidents, philanthropists, celebrities, professional athletes, and the Midland Lee Rebels. You may not like it, you may not get it, but the winning culture and tradition of Lee High School is for real for many Midlanders. It is a major part of who they are, and their loyalty to the school is second to none. On July 27th, the Midland ISD Board of Trustees voted 6-1 to rename Robert E. Lee High School. The board followed district policy on renaming a school by forming a citizens renaming committee to recommend a new name. District policy mandates that the committee must be made up of a central office administrator as chairman, a representative from each school board district, a principal, and two teachers. For this particular task, the board voted to add another chairman, two at-large members, and another representative from each school district board. The board also added two Lee High School students to the committee. On August 6th, the Citizens Renaming Committee was formed. From the onset, there were questions from the public about the makeup of the committee, who was on it, why they were on it, and was it fair. To the board's credit, the committee is diverse on every front and is representative of the public. All members of the committee are required to have a past or present association with Lee High School. There are also those with ties to not only to Lee, but Midland High, George Washington Carver High, Permian, Midland Christian, and several transplants without a longtime connection to our town. The 23 committee members included individuals who range in age from teen to senior citizen. Our committee is comprised of 4 African-American males, 4 Hispanic males, 3 Caucasian males, 1 African-American female, 3 Hispanic females, and 8 Caucasian females. The co-chairs immediately began planning for the committee's work. Over a 4-day period, the co-chairs spent more than 9 hours forming meeting and voting procedures, putting together agendas, and laying out guidelines on how we would conduct our work. There were things to consider, like speaking order, how long a member could talk, the configuration of the room, and even what we would eat and drink. The co-chairs sought counsel from the school district's attorney every step of the way in order to ensure equity and fairness of the process. In the end, the final recommendation to the board would be the school name with the most votes on our committee. The co-chairs also believed that it was important to present the second and third place name proposals as well to ensure that each opinion on the committee was represented in the voting. As our work officially began on August 20th in the Lee High School Library, it was apparent that our group was highly committed, strong, and a true representation of our great city. Contrary to what many would like to think, there was little arguing or raised voices. There were well-thought-out opinions and heartfelt testimonials on both sides of the issue. It didn't take long to see the distinct divide between those who wanted to preserve and recognize some form of the school legacy and those who wanted to wipe the slate clean and begin afresh. As the meetings progressed, the line in the sand became deeper and wider, and discussions and tempers shorter. It was time to vote. Although the top three names and mascots that have come out of our committee might not be your pick, the diligent work of our group cannot be denied. The committee met 6 times for more than 12.5 hours. The co-chairs met 13 times for more than 20 hours. This has not been easy. It has not been pretty. All 23 members have spent hours in meetings, conversations, reflection, and prayer. We have been mocked, criticized, and blamed. The time devoted and sacrifice made to be part of this committee are to be commended. When you take a step back and study the breakdown of the voting, the balance of the committee put together by the Board of Trustees is undeniable. Observing the results by gender, 6 females voted for Legacy, while the other 6 females voted for Tall City. 6 males voted for Legacy, compared to 3 males who voted for Tall City. 1 male did not vote, and the other voted for Carver. Once again, equity was prevalent in the voting process, as ethnicity was not a dividing factor in the result. 2 African-American members, 3 Hispanic members, and 7 Caucasians voted for Legacy, 2 African-American, 3 Hispanic, and 4 Caucasian voted for Tall City. 1 African-American cast his vote for Carver. Furthermore, the 2 at-large members voted differently, as did the 2 lead teachers in Districts 4 and 6. Conversely, the 2 students, Districts 1, 3, 5, and 7, and co-chairs voted in unity for the name. Also important to note is that the vote of the co-chairs did not determine any of the results. With or without the co-chair votes, no outcome would change. It's hard to imagine a more equitable committee when looking at every angle of our process. One uniting point in our committee was the discussion of George Washington Carver High School and the incredible legacy of those who attended the all-black school in Midland. Through stories and testimonials of a committee member who attended Carver, we all felt the weight of the great injustices done through the lack of recognition of academic and extracurricular success at Carver. You could still see the pain of state championships never properly celebrated, trophies discarded, and history brushed under the rug. Our committee was united in bringing a new awareness to the accomplishments of Carver alumni, and several members of our group and community are taking action to bring recognition to the legacy of Carver High School. As students return to classrooms, bands march and teams battle together on the field and court, there's nothing that can bring people together like the common goal of rooting a team on to victory. As we've all seen since the decision on July 27th, there's also nothing that can tear apart like taking your name. What can we do as a community to come together after all the hurt? Can we all refocus our energy and time on our youth in Midland? If we aren't looking ahead to our future, then where is our hope? We've all heard through this process that there are no winners. Most of us have said it is ourselves. Regardless of the name of our school, can we all agree to get behind each kid to promote equality, to meet basic needs, to challenge them academically, and to cheer them all on in their endeavors? What if we all embraced progress and decided to empower our students? We can win. We win with kids. If you would like more information about the committee members, meeting, and voting process, please write the Citizens Renaming Committee page on the school district's website.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.